I remember comparing budgets behind closed doors with other big financials, and they would have 100, 150 people in IAM, and I had like 1.5. And I almost feel like this, when I look at this graph that shows what people are investing in, I feel like it's more influenced by marketing than it is by threat intel.
The Adversarial Podcast. Why you gotta be so adversarial? It's time to get adversarial.
Welcome back to the Adversarial Podcast. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Good to see you guys, Mario and Sunil. What do you guys got going on? Mario, what's new with you? What have you been up to?
Well, I ate a lot of turkey. I took a nice break, and it was great and wonderful. Recharged the battery. And then yesterday, we're all getting invited to dinners and events hosted by, companies, security companies or investors, et cetera, et cetera. And it feels too orchestrated. I feel uncomfortable, in other words. But yesterday's event was great. I was around my tribe. I was really happy. There were around 50 to 70 CISOs, West Coast, and the fine folks. I just want to shout out. I know we don't usually do this, but shout out to the fine folks at Hitch Partners, YL Ventures, and Notable Capital. They really did a great job. My buddies from SVCI were wearing jackets. I was kind of upset because they didn't warn me about wearing a jacket. Like everyone was wearing. Anyway, so it was just great.
But I know they had jeans on. I know that. Because it was a West Coast thing.
Yes.
Hey, let me ask you, and don't worry, Sunil, I'm going to get to you and what you're up to, too. But this is a topic in itself, Mario, okay? So you guys are both in SVCI. That group, Notable, is the big guy behind SVCI. But it was not an SVCI event, though? Was there a lot of overlap with SVCI membership?
No, it wasn't an SVCI event, but Oren, who leads Notable, he's, I think, managing partner at Notable. He also leads SVCI. He's kind of the ringleader for us, and he's put the program together. It's a great program. I think you'll agree with me on that. And anyway, so it was just, bottom line, it was just a really good place to be. Safe place, talked about families, talked about security stuff that we're concerned about. And invariably, we got into this topic between East Coast versus West Coast CISOs. And, and here's what we said from a West Coast perspective about East Coast CISOs. They always talk about risk. Everything's risk-based, right? And we West Coast folks are more into the tech. We're more like, tell us the cool tech. Don't worry about risk. Just tell me about the tech.
Yeah. But I find, like, even on the tech, like, let's talk about that the East Coast CISOs are talking about access control infrastructure, fleet computing, like laptop controls, DLP, et cetera. And that, to me, the West Coast CISOs are talking about AppSec and shift left, code security all the time. Is there any validity to that?
Yeah.
You see the same thing?
Yeah.
I think it's all about prioritizing what kind of attack surfaces folks have, right? So a lot of West Coast CISOs, of course, are software companies, and therefore AppSec is the most prevalent concern. Whereas the East Coast CISOs and East Coast companies aren't just software companies; they're much more mature businesses in most cases, and as a result, we have a lot more attack surfaces that we need to account for.
Well, you know what? I'll tell you what. Then let me test a little thing here. I sometimes say AppSec is overrated, and it pisses some people off. But what I mean by that is, I think to your point that those companies that are all tech stack, it makes sense to emphasize there. And at the end of the day, you should just look at the top, either near misses or things that actually led to an incident. And if those are code flaws, then go nuts. You invest in AppSec. But I feel like more times than not, they aren't. That usually they are misconfigurations in your cloud security posture, or what's rampant today is either BYOD or the inverse of that, which is overly doing too much personal computing on the corporate stack, all that kind of stuff. And those types of companies, I feel like, are overinvesting when they're going through the nitty-gritty of SAST and trying to do more integration in the IDE. And I just feel like they're overinvesting in areas that aren't really leading to the big issues. Is that, So in general, I think AppSec is overrated for a lot of companies, but do you think that's not true and that shift left is still important?
Well, so first of all, the cyber defense matrix that I created was partly to help us remember that there are these other attack surfaces. And if we become too ingrained on one particular one, it's just a reminder to say, hey, just keep in mind that these other attack surfaces might exist, and you want to prioritize the ones that matter most to you. If you're seeing attacks emerge in the application space, then okay, yeah, you rightfully should handle those. But know that attackers are going to find other ways in and other weak points, and that could be your developer's Plex server at home and using the computer that they use at home to then pivot into your corporate environment at work, right? The device that they're using is also an attack surface. And if you don't pay attention to that, at some point, that's going to also bite you in the butt.
I'm kind of on the fence. You know, I'm not a big fan of static code analysis, looking for security problems in that in the actual code. And I just because there's not a lot of benefit that comes out. Maybe it was 10 years, 15 years ago. Maybe I'm giving our space a little bit more credit, but I think a lot of engineers are getting better at some of the more basic coding practices for security. I'm just going to leave that out there. I'm trying to be optimistic, okay? But I tend to be with you more, Jerry. I think there is, first of all, attackers are opportunists, okay? They're not out there to go and try to find the biggest security hole in the world and publish it. Not the attackers who want to get in and make money. They're opportunists. And so oftentimes you're going to find misconfigurations being the cause of a lot of these problems and initial entries for an attacker to gain access.
Well, it's funny. I was talking with a venture friend earlier. He pinged me. He's looking at a startup. What do I think? And it was one that assists with remediating, well, I'll call SAS findings. So it's basically an IDE plugin that's using an AI, kind of like a Copilot. I don't know what's different about it than Copilot, to fix the findings. And you know, what I often say when I'm talking to VCs is, like, first of all, it may make you a fortune even if I'm right about what's wrong with it. So there's a divorce between profitability and kind of righteousness for sake of security. But to me, fixing the stuff that comes out of SAST and all that, like, is kind of a waste of investment. I mean, unless you got everything else licked, by all means, go to their next. But for most companies to then double down on – and so we started talking. He said, well, when – you know, in your – working when you worked as a CISO, what did you do about SAS findings? And I said, you know, in our program, we spent all of our maturity cycle when it came to AppSec around coverage, really. So we said, like, let's inventory all of our apps and let's make sure that the ones that are important enough are covered by SAS with a certain frequency and all of that. And we worked and burned down those metrics over probably several years to go from crap coverage to 90%+ coverage and then kind of pat ourselves on the back. We didn't get to, okay, now what about the actual findings? It was just making sure they were running. And I just felt like if the engineers had an IDE that was doing some kind of SAST and warning them on the fly and educating them, that the mission was kind of done. I didn't want to route all the findings to my team and then go through. It was so inefficient. It was like a 10,000-to-1 hit ratio on something that SAST says is important to something that I need to really be worried about.
I think that's why tools like SEMGREP are actually really interesting to me, because first of all, it's a developer-first tool that solves a problem that a developer has, not a problem that security has. And if there's security benefits that we get from using something like SEMGREP by putting in small little checks that we do care about from a security standpoint, then everyone wins. And it happens as the developer's using it, not retrospectively after the fact when security inserts themselves into the picture.
The way he actually put the question was like, didn't you have SLAs around fixing issues? I said, well, absolutely. But SAS findings aren't issues. Like, there needs to be a massive funnel to go from the tool barking to actually having an issue, which then would fall under an SLA. And if you looked at, like, things that come out of, and this isn't any specific ex-employer mind, this is just all my experiences holistically. If you look at what should have kept people up at night, like the things that would lead to either an actual incident or to a hot enough red team finding that you'd say, whoa, we just barely dodged one. Actually having developers and code fixing stuff happens sometimes, but if you rule out, like, including vulnerable libraries, open source libraries, like SCA? Because that's a big chunk, but your SAST isn't for that, right? It's for homegrown code. The stuff where they're actually fixing that was really damn rare, and it had to be like a bespoke app, like SQL injection. Most of these organizations, these apps are post-authentication, which lowers the attack surface dramatically and onward. So, yeah, I don't feel like SAST is really a priority.
You know, it's interesting you bring both of you bring this angle, because I'm a big fan of SendGrep, and we use SendGrep at when I was at Snowflake, right? And, you know, you have two different engineering teams. One team is building native application code for the services that we were providing to customers. We are the SaaS vendor. And then the other engineering team was more of the IT folks integrating with SaaS applications that somebody built. So they still have to code things, but it's not as in you're building a new product. You're basically interacting programmatically with a SaaS vendor's application API. Okay, so far so good? Okay, so SendGrep, huge success in the engineering team that was building Snowflake native code. And to Sunil's point, I mean, already Sunil's highlighted why SendGrep, and I'm not here to sell the product SendGrep, and I haven't invested in them, but good people, good product. Anyway, so people really benefited, engineers did, in that side of the fence. We tried SendGrep on the IT engineers developing for connecting to SaaS applications. Complete waste of time, failure. They didn't see any benefit of it. So it could be that connection with what you're saying, Jerry, that if you're interacting with a SaaS application, you're dealing more with like updating data, bringing data, maybe running reports programmatically, but maybe there's nothing native code that you're really building and that doesn't introduce a complexity as opposed to you building an application yourself.
Yeah, I mean, it's just the poster child for low fidelity findings, I think. Yeah, SaaS and maybe some of the CSPM stuff that's really just ripping through. And when I talk to people and say, hey, why don't you integrate your security findings into a common risk register, they often will say, whoa, you want me to bring Wiz stuff? Are you nuts? Like, you're talking about hundreds of thousands of things. It's like, okay, yeah, whoa, yeah, sorry, that's not what I meant. You got to pre-screen the lower fidelity sources. Not the crap on Wiz, it's just the class. It's just if you're going through config files and configs and finding stuff, you're going to find a lot of noise. So, Mario, that's what you did last night. Cool. Sunil, you're on your world junket. You look like you're a hostage in some room.
I'm not sure if, but the door I have here, I need a key to actually unlock the door. So if I lose the key, then I'm actually stuck.
Is this a proof of life video, Sunil? Are you on a proof of life video? What's going on here, dude?
Country with no fire code.
I'll clap and stuff so you know I'm not a deep fake. But yes, I'm actually in Greece. And I was in Saudi Arabia last week, Frankfurt this week, Greece this week, and then Tel Aviv next week.
Were you at the Black Hat Middle East?
Yes, I was. I missed out on the adventures or misadventures because I left early to go back home for Thanksgiving. But yes, I was part of that group that had some interesting
How did
adventures.
Such a huge group of like security people that I know end up at Black Hat Middle East? Was that organized by
I missed this. What's going
See,
on?
See, Mario, you're in the same boat. I was like 6 hours ago.
I was completely missed. What?
And Alan Alford fell and got busted up to pieces.
What?
And the poor guy has got a bunch of broken bones and stuff in Saudi.
So I'm going to over-dramatize this purposefully.
Let's go.
But so Gary was – so there's this thing
Gary
in Saudi Arabia
Haisler.
Called – yeah. So there's this thing called Edge of the World in Riyadh. It's just – this massive cliff, and Gary Haislip, his namesake, he slipped coming down from a particular mound, and he slipped started to fall head first, over the cliff. Apparently, again, I might be dramatizing this, but he was about to fall head first down the cliff, but thankfully, Alan Alford was there to catch him, or at least to serve as a as a cushion so that Gary wouldn't hurt his head. So Gary still hurt himself, but not as badly as a result, because Alan took all the brunt of the fall. And so Alan hurt himself pretty badly, his knee probably is going to have to go get some surgery.
Wow. Wow, what a mess. So you were over there, you dodged that bullet, and now you're in Greece. Are you mainland, or are you, you must not be on the island.
No, I'm on the continent.
I know you don't know what words to use. I didn't either. Mainland, I don't know. Yeah, all right, cool.
Jerry, what's up with this? You and I, only the cool kids get invited to the cool things.
So I didn't get invited cool to that thing.
We didn't get invited. That's why you know we're not cool anymore. Well, maybe like we're never
I would have
cool.
felt bad if I got invited, because I don't think I could have made that lift, and I would have felt like always wondered if I would have regretted it. Although I guess I would have had the answer after
because,
that.
You would have either hurt yourself like the others did, or you would have missed Thanksgiving, or nearly missed Thanksgiving, and that would have been bad.
Forget it. What was that organized through, like a venture group that with affiliation or anything like that, or was it just?
No, it's the Saudis who want to rig your phone with Pegasus malware. That's all.
Oh, okay. Well, no wonder you ran iVerify. I get it. All right, but we'll get to that later. All right. Well, speaking of the kind of the CISO thought whispers and all of that, Andy Ellis published something. A quick lighthearted article about CISO budgets going into the new year and that sort of thing, and what the priorities are. And my quick takeaway was that last year was a downturn, and this year it seems to be going recovered, maybe not fully, but that it's up again. Is that surprising to you guys?
So I've heard the similar sentiments that the budgets have. For the majority of people, it's either been stable or gone up slightly. And I think that's just part of the perspective of the economy, because I think a lot of people held off in the first half of 2024, just seeing how things will play out. And then the second half, they started to release funds and drive the economy forward.
Yeah. So just a macro thing. Okay,
I'm just excited to see the two highest spend budget line items. Sunil's in one, and I'm on the other one. Yeah.
Well, so I mean, I think so that the two items that for those who are listening, the two items that according to Andy had the most amount of spend is identity, shocker.
Yeah.
And then the second one is Gen AI. Again, shocker, I'm sure. But I would say one of the things that's hidden. That it's not really it's not so obvious because it's not a technology spend, but I also hear a lot of people wanting to like optimize their tooling, because effectively we have so many of these tools already, and if I'm spending money to make the tool work better in some way, to take the tools I already have and make them more effective, or to do the integration, whatever it is, okay. Somehow that doesn't really get captured here. Like what category is that in? Right.
Yeah.
But if I were to have another line item for just like tool optimization or something like that, I would bet you that gets a pretty significant amount of attention.
Yeah. I've known a few startups in that space, and they're very small and early. So it may just be that while there's interest yet, the numbers aren't there, but I wouldn't be surprised. Of the enterprise market, of the people who have overbought a bunch of tools and need to consolidate,
I think it's a great. Well, Sunil, there was a couple of former colleagues of mine and I were looking into looking at this space. I think it is really. Not that we did anything. Maybe that's a hint, but I think I think you're right. I think, first of all, most of us CISOs get bombarded with security applications that mostly replace existing security tools with something else. So you got to replace, rip and replace oftentimes. You don't get these unique technologies. And they do happen, but not as often. What you don't hear about is, okay, how do you make my investment, the things that I've already invested in, better, more functional, more effective, which is what Sunil's saying. And it's surprising nobody's really been doing that. Now, when I looked into this space with my former colleagues, a lot of it is the ability to collect this data, being able to connect to all these different applications and make sense of that data and then report back on how they're performing. And that's the problem, is the collection of the data and the quality of the data can send the wrong signals at times. So it's I'm not saying it's impossible, but you gotta, I actually am being very gung-ho about AI in this space. Make the data cleaner, better, more actionable, and then maybe we can take some steps like what Sunil's suggesting.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, when I looked at this, I see identity right at the top. And I spoke with someone not that long ago who's looking at where they're going to do their next startup. And they concluded identity. We all know Will Lin, right, who went from venture into startup himself. He was out on that Saudi junket, apparently, too.
The cool kids. There's the cool
kids. The coolest of kids. Yeah, so he did the same thing, right? He was an investor and said, I want to get into this game. What do I pick? He looked around. He ended up on identity. There's a lot of emphasis on identity. I feel like, and I swear I don't go into these conversations just trying to be contrarian, maybe adversarial, but not contrarian. But I that always kind of shocked me. Like, I remember comparing budgets behind closed doors with other big financials, and they would have 100, 150 people in IAM, and I had like 1.5, I mean, you know? And I almost feel like this, when I look at this graph that shows what people are investing in, I feel like it's more influenced by marketing than it is by threat intel.
Mm.
And I feel like threat intel is the right way. Maybe I'm wrong about that. Mm. But that we should be analyzing what's going wrong at companies like us and investing to avoid that outcome. I can think of some things around identity, like credential stuffing, I guess, ATO. But there's no 150-person IAM team isn't helping with any of those problems.
ATO and stuffing is customer identity facing. Access management. But the former employer, we had 600 people or so doing access operations, mm-hmm. right? And that was largely because we had a lot of bespoke applications that you really couldn't easily automate the access provisioning process, right? Mm-hmm. So it's bundled under the identity program or IAM program. Mm-hmm. I don't know what your one person did, but that also kind of suggests to me that you...
UARs, just UARs. That's what was in security. It wasn't provisioning. Yeah.
Okay. So if you didn't have provisioning, I mean, I would have said the 150 people that you, the other company you referred to, I bet you many of them were access operations.
Yeah. Well, what I've seen, to your point, these big enterprises, they spend a ton of money because they have a bunch of legacy apps, and someone came in from SailPoint or whatever it is, and I'm just mentioning them because I like to do it on this podcast because I think we can just talk candidly, and if people say, "Hey, you're wrong about it," correct me, and I'll retract. But people say, well, you want to be able to have one click disable from an employee being terminated, from starting with HR, and you want them out of all 183 legacy apps that they were in. Yeah. And instead, they're failing, and PwC and Deloitte are hitting them year after year with findings where, well, we reviewed and we found 6,439 in a really big org instances where terminated employees still had access. Who cares? That's stupid. That has nothing to do with cybersecurity. All those internal apps, they could have people in for the next 75 years. You can't even get to them until you get on the network, right? There's core apps that get you through the front door, and we need to disable those instantly. But that long tail, it's not risk-based. West Coast CISO, sorry. But that's not a risk-based approach, and there's investing a fortune just to pass audit a little better, but it has nothing to do with any of the compromises we're hearing about.
Yeah. I would agree with you on the general perspective that those systems may not or don't matter. I think if I were an auditor, I would be more concerned about the overall processes that causes those gaps to occur. So why are those gaps happening?
That's right, right there.
Yeah,
right,
but that's letting perfect be the enemy of good, because you're right. And if you can – this reminds me of my buddy John Rogers at MSCI. He's an awesome CISO. And when I talk about – like patch management, and I kind of have the same approach to that. Like, you don't have to patch like crazy and everything. You just have to patch the things that are exploitable from the public today. And I generally feel that way. And when I walk into most shops, I find that they're over-indexing and trying to just patch everything with operational risk. And his approach, which is awesome, is that it should be about currency. Like, being, if you're able to keep every single package up to date, then you've fought the right battles and you've won, and you've got this resiliency and this agility within your organization. Because if you're able to do that, and just within hours of something coming out, you've got it deployed, then you've solved so many problems that you know you can react to anything else. And he is right. But I think that for most organizations, that and the ability to just instrument, and it's just utopian. And at a really big org, the minute that you catch up, you're going to either divest half of the things that you've spent all this money integrating to, or buy six new subs that are coming to the enterprise that aren't yet integrated. You got to plan for, the island of misfit toys. That's the reality of life. And if you just keep beating the drum that you want everything to be perfect, you're never going to get anywhere.
I think that's a valid point, Jerry. But in this world that's more connected, a VPN and shutting somebody's access to a VPN into your enterprise may not be enough. I think their enterprises have gotten more and more hybrid, and it's making things more challenging to shut the door. So Neil's highlighting a really important point is it's not necessarily that we have, 0.5% of employees don't get terminated in 24 hours after they get terminated. Okay, got it. It's more about the process. Do you even have a process? Is your process working for that? And the problem is, they're looking at the financial. If you're a public company, they're going to look at UAR, user access review, on these financial applications. And they're using this user access as a process, as a gauge of how mature your process is. I don't know.
Well, I wish they did use it as a proxy of maturity. But, I mean, we're talking about IT general controls, right? Sarbanes-Oxley. And remember, mm-hmm. their remit is to make sure you're not Enroning it. I mean, that's why this exists. That's where SOX came from. It was, 100%. Are you cooking the books?
Yeah.
And to make the connection between Janice in AR's past account not being disabled after she left to cooking the books, it's just really, I think it's just easy to audit. Things that are easy to look at BitSight, right?
100%.
The reason why BitSight is a mess is because all they can focus on are things that are easy to hit from the web. So now everybody cares about TLS version support, which is so asinine. And I think there's a big analog to that in user access recertifications on non-external facing systems. We're just fixing the things that the auditors can audit.
Let me ask you a question. Were you able to push back on the auditors and tell them this is bullpup?
Yeah.
This is
all
successful. Be successful.
And so can you at home. Yeah, honestly, this is a really good point. What the auditors never audit against UAR. What auditors audit against is your policy, right? So the first time they come into a small shop, you're just about to go public, you're doing your prep. Oh, you don't have a policy on user terminations? You need one. Okay, you got it. They come back next time. Oh, Mario, you wrote a policy saying you're going to terminate all access within 24 hours, and we found all these exceptions. Where'd you screw up? You shouldn't have said 24 hours. So what I think really works, and you don't want to just say, we're never going to bounce them in the policy. Ha ha, I tricked you. That's a little extreme. But what does work is to say, this 6% of our systems are the keys to the kingdom. They're external. They're the VPN. They're SaaS apps that can't be under the IDP. They are the IDP, and so on. And we're going to bounce those within whatever you want, 2 hours, 4 hours. And this other 94% of the apps, we're going to be perfectly comfortable with doing quarterly catch-ups. You are the DBA that runs this Sybase app that we just couldn't get into SailPoint, and I can't ping you every 5 minutes about disabling, but once a quarter, I'm going to give you a list of the 134 people that are gone, you're going to reconcile, and I'm going to be good enough with that by policy. And then you're good in audit, too.
Prove to me that disabling the VPN will disable their ability to get in.
So that you should be an auditor, right? But right. that would be the right audit question.
Jerry, I mean, I think your point is right, but you just have to be ready to defend it and say you can't access these applications because of this VPN. Here's a firewall. I get it, but I think it's a valid point.
And auditors, they like that. They like intentionality. If something thought out, you paper that up, you explain it, you put in. So be careful, and a good overall rule is be careful when anybody puts in policy to make an auditor go away, because they're going to come back and audit you against what you just wrote. So make sure it's not unrealistic. All right. A few different headlines in here. I thought we should have a segment on the show where we talk about politics every single time. No, that's a joke. I don't feel that way.
I'm getting high.
But look, there's a lot of politics news coming out. And so I think we'll talk about more of the ramifications of it in the indirect. So a few of the things that caught my eye is the cabinet is being formed out for the new administration here in the U.S. And David Sachs was named as what they're calling AI and crypto czar. And I need to see the job description when that comes out. And he probably does, too, to see what that means. But the trend in that and all the discussion is all around decreasing regulation. Right? That's the trend. People are banking on indirectly. You see some markets moving, some liquidity increasing. Some people feel that there's going to be more exits, more venture activity. You see, on an adjacent note, crypto prices popping up. It's adjacent because the idea there is it'll be less regulation, more people will be able to invest in crypto, if not initial coin offerings and that sort of thing. Maybe you'll see more ETFs and more hybrid instruments that allow people to get their money into crypto and out of crypto and all of that. Do you guys feel like this is going to make a difference? And when it comes to like cyber regulation in particular, do you feel like net-net we would win with less regulation, or would it impose more harm and danger?
Okay, well, when it comes to regulation, let's talk about whether it's AI regulation or crypto, because you kind of talked about both. So when the frontier providers say we need more, when the people who are building AI systems say we need more regulation, I would generally say that's probably something that we should heed their caution. In other words, the people who will be most disadvantaged in being regulated, if they're saying, please regulate us, that is something that we should probably do. So if they're, if the administration is coming in to release some of that, I would be deeply concerned. When it comes to crypto, okay, deregulating crypto, I didn't realize it was regulated to begin with. That's why.
Oh, sorry. That's a good point. Established, but, yeah. Well, I mean, I guess in the absence of regulation, some things are just banned outright. So you can call that regulation.
Making it more of a stable form of currency for transactions and such, which is happening. I think in general, though, I would say with Bitcoin hitting the benchmark price of 100K, I couldn't be happier, not just because I happen to have some Bitcoin, but because if you've ever read Tracers in the Dark, Bitcoin is so traceable, it's amazing. And so to have all these criminal actors using Bitcoin, not realizing how traceable it is, how wonderful that is, because at some point, you know, they'll get caught, okay? But that's also the danger I'm concerned about, which is at some level, a lot of these criminal actors will hopefully realize at some point that, hey, maybe they should come off of Bitcoin and use something else. And who knows what that something else is going to be. But that at that point, I can see Bitcoin prices potentially dropping as a result of the criminal side of the equation abandoning it because it's so traceable. Go through the book, Tracers in the Dark. Wonderful book.
Yeah.
Gives you both a view of how horrible people are, but also some hope in what we can do to stop them.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, back on the big regulatory picture, you know, what I think about when it comes to cyber regs, remember we talked about a few episodes ago against a potential new healthcare cyber reg, and I at least was arguing there that we should just have one standard framework, not a new standard, but just pick CISA's guidance or whatever it's going to be. And anything sector specific should just say you should adhere to their guidance about data or about sabotage or whatever it is. But what I see all the time is, I mean, like SOC 2 and even ISO, you know, you're not going to call that a regulation. It's not something that's going to get unwound. But the idea of people trying to come up with this blueprint and then, you know, totally myopically over-indexing on adhering to that blueprint is a massive distraction to me in cyber programs. You know, you see so many, and their only interest is getting a SOC 2 report, which is pretty easy to do without touching security, without doing anything that's going to decrease the chances of an incident. And so if that's some analog for regulatory burden in general, then, yeah, it would be great to get that out of the way.
I tend to go towards libertarian, I guess, being in Silicon Valley, right? So I believe the market can, I wouldn't say self-correct, but it's probably one of the best signals, especially if there's a pricing, something associated with a cost for some from unit that you're buying. It's good to have that not being centralized, managed. So I do believe in some less regulation is better, especially if the type of regulations are left for interpretation by the enforcers. I think that's where things get kind of uncomfortable for some people, especially in business, when the regulations are too generic, and it's like, well, just make it black and white for me, so my company doesn't get in trouble. The worst position is, I mean, even when you think about SOX, when SOX was first started, remember SOX in 2005, 2004, 2005, 2006. we were one. I worked at a company called Moody's, you know, the rating company, and we were one of the first companies to go through this SOX audit. Okay, first maybe two, three handful of companies officially, and the auditors just didn't understand how to interpret SOX, so they started coming out with all these different things that weren't really written there, but they were interpreting it and causing a lot of heartburn for us, and it took a while. Mm-hmm. For companies to understand how to interpret SOX and make it kind of a regular game, you know, how do you comport yourself in business? I think that's the big problem in regulations when it's too generic. On the other side, I worry about we human beings have a tendency to F up things really quickly, okay? And sometimes we need to have a little bit of checks and balances because we can kind of get ourselves into a little trouble, right? I worry about AI. Sunil, maybe I'm overreacting, but I think some sort of oversight, not too much, but some oversight by the people that understand this space to put some sort of guardrails so we don't get so much into trouble. I mean, what do you think of that, Sunil? You're in the AI space.
Well, okay, so when it comes to regulations and regulatory theory, there's two ways to look at the how you impose controls. One is if you understand the process extremely well and your regulators are also experts, then you could actually regulate the process. So for example, drug manufacturing is a great example. FDA has a lot of experts who are part of the FDA, and they understand how these things work. And so they can regulate drug manufacturing at a very tight level.
Yeah.
But pollution DXP. Is different. Pollution is different because you can't, you don't know how the sausage is made, so to speak. And so you can only regulate the outcome and say, here's the outcome that we're trying to avoid. And you say, okay, I don't care how you want to produce your sausage. You need to stay under these thresholds for pollution. Okay, so now when it comes to either AI or the whole, I'm trying to figure out how to apply this in the crypto world, but there are things that, especially in AI, the process piece is really not well understood, right? And certainly I can't imagine there's a regulator that can have the expertise that we need. So at best, we regulate the outcomes. The question is, what outcomes do we want or not want? And that's, I think, part of the challenge that that I think this new guy is going to have to figure out. And then with crypto, that's another sort of consideration here, because there's a huge benefit in the U.S. being, or the U.S. dollar being the world's reserve currency. And so
We Americans have benefited tremendously.
Absolutely. And we benefit, of course, from the standpoint of being able to drive other people's actions based on how we sanction them, right? And so this is one of the things that we've struggled with sanctions. What's the goal that we want to achieve in a particular sanction? And sometimes that's not clear, and so the sanctions don't really have as much of an effect as we'd like. Well, it may be the same sort of question that I would have for crypto. What is it that we want to achieve when it comes to having some sort of regulation around crypto? Because whatever goal that is, if it's to deregulate it so that more people use crypto, just know that we may be shooting ourselves in the foot by also diminishing the value of the world's currency, the reserve currency that we have.
All right. From the nerding out corner, I thought it was worth talking about GitHub access control a little bit, because I keep running into these things where I find something that I think a company should improve on control-wise. And then when I start to do it, I immediately realize it's probably like 90%+ of the world has the same problem, and we're not talking about it for some reason. So part of it was, GitHub access control. And in particular, the idea that once people are logging into GitHub with SSO somehow, which I think a lot of that's not even happening, where people are forcing them to use a company login versus permissioning their personal login into company repos. So requiring them to invoke a company login through SSO, that's great. But I think most companies, and that's a pretty bold statement, I think most GitHub users, GitHub corporate enterprises are allowing access to all their source code from unmanaged devices, from home computers. And I think most CISOs, no less CTOs and CIOs, that would say, no, 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 we don't do that, need to dig a little deeper because they probably are doing that. Right? So, I mean, do you even force people to be on enterprise hardware in order to use SSO and log in through your IDP? That's not trivial. A lot of people aren't doing that. But then even if you do, the fact that people really work with GitHub via SSH and that you can cut a key pair there that you've generated on any computer means there's probably a whole lot of BYOD, not malicious, not for malicious purposes, but devices out there that have access to either view code or contribute to code from unmanaged devices.
Yeah.
And this is a really complicated kind of whole of IT effort to be able to fix this at places. Do you agree that this is probably the state of play everywhere in general? And is it a concern?
No, no. So, well, okay. So first of all, we have the future is already here. It's just unevenly distributed. And if we consider Google's Salsa efforts to move, even to be able to define something like Salsa 4, okay, which is a pretty aggressive, I won't go into the details of it, but it's a pretty aggressive state where all the type of things that, Jerry, you just mentioned you were concerned about are actually addressed and even more, right? And so this perspective of how do you achieve that state and some small pockets of the universe, maybe it's achievable, but that's a pretty aggressive state to be in. But that's it. Let's just assume Salsa 4 is just kind of out of reach for most people. But let's consider something like Salsa 2 or Salsa 3.
Sunil, just to highlight to your point, the Salsa guys went and started a company called ChainGuard. And there are VCs putting a lot of money. So even though, and by the way, we did go through Salsa. I'm a big fan of Salsa. We have gone through this framework, but just highlighting
and
that.
And ChainGuard's great. Yeah. And that's really, I think, but this is what I was going to point out, which is that folks like Dan at ChainGuard, what they're doing is making this easier for people to implement.
Yeah.
And the patterns that companies like Google who have this, who built these sort of controls in place, and certainly Apple and whatever else it might be, no, they have figured it out, and we just need to be able to somehow catch up. And hopefully some of these startups will help us accelerate towards that. But the general state is what Jerry put out, which is we don't really have those design patterns readily available for us to implement because it's just too hard. And companies like ChainGuard, if they can help us do it, you know, more power to that.
Yeah. We went through this. I went through this when I was at Snowflake because we did, you know, look at Salsa, looked at all these frameworks. We do see an importance on that. Boy, this is a hornet's nest for anybody who's going to go through this. And I think for us CISOs, I often think that we CISOs we're probably more in the business of psychology than we are in technology, or we're kind of a psychologist with a tech background, because really, you really got to look at these human systems, these things that we built. Case in point, GitHub. GitHub was an open source. Somebody keep me honest. It was kind of an open source where community where uploaded code and everybody shared their code and brag about their code. Not brag about it, but hey, the more people use your code that you developed, the more kudos you got. And people even use them. Engineers use them as part of their interviewing process or their resumes, right? So it's a big deal. There's this community sense. Community sometimes doesn't go well when you start clamping down on things and making them more controlled. And so we decided to obviously implement single sign-on, enforce it with our devices as well, laptops, only trusted laptops. And as we're going through all of that, you start finding out this interesting stuff with SSH that everybody's been using. So you can disable an employee from using single sign-on, but if they have a repo inside your organization's GitHub and they're using their own SSH keys, they still have access. Okay? So think about going through this whole single sign-on. And by the way, we got rid of that. We were able to block SSH, da-da-da. But boy.
Not easy, right?
I mean, not easy at all. It took a while, and people were freaking pissed when we did it. All right? I'm telling you, pissed.
Yeah.
But it goes back to the whole
what
community.
So there's the non-human identity angle to all this, too, especially, right? And service accounts and that sort of thing. And I mean, you have to use a combination of agents and IP address restrictions. And on, and that doesn't play nicely with non-human identities at all, right? So I was chatting with somebody about this, and I don't remember if it was one of you guys or one of my other two friends in life, but the idea came up of once you win and you've locked everything down, then you find that there's like integrations that are sitting out on the perimeter that are talking to SaaS apps, and they need to have access to GitHub, and they're using ephemeral IPs. You can't use the IP address restriction and all that, and you've locked down your repos, and so the engineers are like, well, I don't want to go against policy. I totally hear you. No worries. I'm not going to work in our repos. I'll just spin up my own.
Yep. Right?
And then you get into the creds and repos and that sort of thing pretty quickly.
Yeah. So and then they'll be upset because if you're like, well, this is code that I want to make sure people know that I'm writing. And engineers, we're kind of cute in some ways. We think this code belongs to us, even though our employer's paying us to write this code. So they invariably want to take their code, their babies with them to other places because they want to reuse the code. I get it. But that code doesn't belong to you, man. It belongs to the company.
So here's a East Coast, West Coast dichotomy that might be worth considering. Developers in the West Coast are like your surgeons and generals. They're the ones who make money for the company, and therefore they get treated like kings and queens. As such, constraining them is really hard. Whereas in the East Coast, the developers, they're just part of the business. They're just, you know, a cog in the wheel, so to speak. They're not the ones who are really making the money. It's the, you know, investment bankers, whatever. You know, there's
different, right.
You know, folks who are making the money. And so we can enforce more controls on the developers because we don't care, right? You want to get a different job somewhere else? Go for it. You know, we'll swap you out with another developer from India, right? So I think that it goes to this notion of if whoever in your organization is treated like the generals or the surgeons or the, you know, whoever, you're going to have to, royalty, you're going to have to essentially relax some of these controls because they're going to have an allergic reaction and not want to work there as a result.
Mm. Yeah. Well, you know, it's pretty interesting. If you went to someone like a senior executive at a company that has interest in cyber and they're committed and they want to, you know, tighten things up for whatever reason, and you said, our source code could go to home computers right now, I think they would all like kind of bristle at that. And, oh, that's awful. Or you say people could check in code from unmanaged devices. Oh, that's awful. That's unacceptable. But if you go back to when we were talking about earlier about threat-led programs, and okay, how often has that manifested in something pretty awful? I mean, the few supply chain issues where people are backdooring software, that didn't require BYOD or whatever, you know, it was a malicious insider or a compromised managed endpoint. So maybe that doesn't really matter. And then likewise, if you think about in our world, all the source code leakage that we track down and care about and panic about, it's always about the fact that someone put credentials in the source code or something stupid like that.
Yeah.
It's never about the IP. It's never about, oh no, they could see what, you know, patterns we used in our coding. So nobody really does care about that. So maybe this is a much bigger, widespread situation than people realize, but it really the answer is to force them to say to come to peace with the fact that there's coding going on from unmanaged devices.
I'll tell you that we did this right after SolarWinds because we felt that anybody going in with untrusted machines or with their own credentials, if they got popped, mm-hmm. and your application's important enough. Critical infrastructure, both of you were critical infrastructure. Maybe not.
No. I got a challenge, but I'll hold off. I'm going to come back to that.
But let's just say, in our case, what we had looked at from our risk base was if somebody were to gain access to our code and modify it and plant themselves, then they somehow could exfiltrate data. And, you know, we were in a data company. And we care about data.
And
so it's a big
customers.
Deal. So, that's right. Exactly.
Yeah. So... Oh, I'm glad you brought that up. So, like, my whole spiel, right, is always threat objectives, right?
Yep.
Sunil has cyber defense matrix. Jerry has threat objectives.
Yeah.
And what I'm always trying to say is that you need to take a company and figure out which things you're worried about, sabotage versus data and so on. One of them is customer targeting. And I created that, added it, originally called it watering hole attacks. That's what I still call it in class. But it was for SolarWinds. And it was saying, like, if you're evaluating your threat, you know, the threat landscape, you now need to also think about what customers do I have that people might want to come through me to get access to them.
That's right.
And I would put, so I always put Cloudflare in there and Snowflake. There's a number of companies that are always on the receiving end of the same threat actors that are very sophisticated. And it's the same kind of people that would walk into SolarWinds. And the reason I brought up now is that you mentioned, like, you kind of said, hey, maybe we have some commonality here being critical infrastructure operators and you. And I think that's the whole threat objective approach is, like, it's not about your designation or there's no, like, more or less important or more or less secure. It's about the threat objective. And so you could be a critical infrastructure provider, and most of them are not a customer targeting thing, though, right? You don't want to backdoor a hydroelectric dam provider and put, you know, tamper with the source code. It's worthless. But you may want to backdoor a software company like Honeywell that provides services to the to the hydroelectric dam company and so on.
Yeah,
it's an interesting distinction. But I think you were totally right.
What is that, Jerry? What is this watering hole?
Customer targeting is the clean thing, because watering hole attack was that, you know, you poison the watering hole if you want to get to the to people that all kind of come around there, and or you lie in wait around the watering hole and you know that all the targets are going to be there, that sort of thing.
Yeah, there was a.
I knew you would have the metaphor for this, Sunil.
Well, no.
The etymology.
There's a very specific set of restaurants and cafes near a certain intelligence facility that we have in the U.S. And that cafe had a menu that people would check. They would download and run, you know, on their computer and check that menu. Okay.
Oh, well, you're kidding me. Oh.
You can figure out the rest, right? You know, you have some cafe that doesn't have much security, but guess who visits that site on a regular basis to check out their menu? That's a watering hole attack.
Oh.
Yeah, exactly. So we'll see about that. But you know, Mario, to your point earlier, I think that what you were doing was, like, bang on correct, where you said they are similar to us in threat profile, right? And that one was kind of easy because you guys are both providing software that operated in a privileged environment. Where people miss it, I think, is like, oh, we're operating financial market infrastructure and we should learn from the Sony Pictures attack from North Korea. Like, oh, different vertical. They would never pay attention to that threat intel. But there, it's sabotage, right? You have, like, a nation-state actor. So, you know, learn from people, even if it's non-obvious metaphors, and identify them by what the bad guys were actually trying to accomplish, the threat objective. Soapbox off. All right. I wanted to talk a little bit about this article that came out from iVerify, who's in the business of like, highly targeted targets of interest, political dissidents, that kind of thing, mobile protection. And they mentioned that they allowed people to run a scan, and they got about 2,500 people to voluntarily do that, and that they found 5 new Pegasus variants. Am I using the terminology right there?
No, not variants. They found 7 people who were infected with the Pegasus malware. And the essence of this was these aren't people who would not necessarily show up on a target list per se, right? So it's clear that the use of Pegasus has gone beyond the intended target population. So that's one. The other thing that I thought was interesting is the technique that iVerify is using. They had to come up with interesting techniques, but the technique that they came up with is just basically you run a standard diagnostic on your phone, and you basically upload that diagnostic to iVerify, and they check that diagnostic for signatures of compromise. So you're not installing an agent on, you're not installing something that monitors, that does, you know, direct monitoring, is just pulling the log files. So I thought that was an interesting technique. Now, the company iVerify does have an agent, and, you know, they do constant scanning and that kind of stuff. But this one was this tool is a $1 app that you download, and it's just all it does is it triggers the diagnostic collection and then sends it for you to have it analyzed. And for $1, I'm like, sure, I'll check it out. Especially since, as I mentioned at the beginning, I visited Saudi Arabia, so I just wanted to, you know, see if there was somebody who was willing to give me a nice Israeli package, Israeli gift.
unexpected gift.
Well, would you? This is really interesting. So tying these two topics together, so if you would you agree that if you were a government cracking down on dissidents and, you know, a utilizer, a leverager of Pegasus, so you got this group that have targeted journalists and that sort of thing, and that's their mission, I would think that those diagnostic dumps off of devices would be gold dust to them. Right? Totally. You're tying names to OS version,
the metadata.
All that. So now let's get back to Watering Hole or customer targeting. I'm hoping that this iVerify company knows. I mean, they have to be getting directly targeted because they've just got 2,500 potential targets to upload all this debug. Not debug, okay, diagnostic data or whatever. You know, and are you subjecting yourself to a little more risk by kind of narrowing the target window by uploading that?
I'm envisioning a bunch of antelopes going to the watering hole to drink, and there's a freaking crocodile just grabbing
them. That's it. That's the watering hole.
There you go.
Yeah. Yeah, that's why crocodiles swim. Yeah, they used to not do that, and they evolved.
Yeah. All right. Oh, man.
Well, you know, on a related note to that, I think so, when it comes to phones and all of that, social engineering, there's a number of headlines out there that are still going on, and social engineering keeps on coming up, and there was a Forbes article there that said that the FBI in particular is warning smartphone users to create a secret word to avoid, in particular, deepfake-related social engineering. And when I read through the article in detail, I ultimately saw it was talking about like with families. Well, actually, I think it said with for family members and contacts, which is like a pretty big, you know, ends of the spectrum there.
Because the contacts become a conduit because you're trusting these contacts.
Yeah.
If they right, that's the problem, right? You trust the contacts, you accept the call or the text, and there you go.
Yeah, and right, how many words are you going to create? How many secret words are you going to manage? Yeah. Right, so it's kind of worse. So you start spamming them out to all the contacts. But look, it seems to me like, you know, we're going to keep chasing technical solutions, but there just needs to be some just default suspicion. Yeah, if it's too good to be true, if somebody's asking you to jump off a bridge or wire $45,000 either way, take some extra diligence, add a band verification, right? That's not new. Is anything really changing?
Yeah, I think the strength of the process that you're introducing has to correspond to the associated damage or risk that you're also taking on. What I thought was really fascinating and useful about this warning from the FBI about creating these code words and secret words is what's best manifested, I think, that the issue that the solution that they're pointing to is best manifested if you think about the evil twin attack. What I mean by this is, imagine, if you will, you had a literal evil, you had a literal twin, identical in every possible way, and they're just evil, okay? And there was a show, and there was a book and a show called Dark Matter on Apple TV. If anyone's seen it, it's a fun show. It's a really fun book, too. But the show is not about deepfakes, but it's about deepfakes. Because what ends up happening, and I'm sorry for those who haven't watched it, I'm going to give you a little bit of a spoiler. The scientist comes up with a way to travel in multiverse, and in the process, he ends up creating identical copies of himself in all these other multiverses. And they all want to go back home to the same home. Okay, so there's a part of the story where all of a sudden you have all these deep fakes, but they're not really deep fakes. They're like really deep, that person. Okay, so how do you tell the difference? So imagine, if you will, at some future state, we have deepfake generating technology that is so good that we can't really tell the difference. Or even today, you have deepfake detection technologies. Let's say it's at this level. Any day, at any point in time, that's going to be defeated by some slightly better deepfake creation technology. So in other words, you can go buy Reality Defender or some technology that will detect deepfakes, and it could be broken at any moment and you don't know. So what do? You come up with process controls. You have to come up with process controls. And those process controls have to be good enough, again, for the scenario or for the business case that you have created those process controls for. If the risk of breaking that process control results in transferring $1 million, you better have a lot of good process controls. But if the risk for that is losing 50 cents, who cares, right? You don't spend that much time on those process controls. So to your point earlier about secret words and so on and so forth, if it's low stakes issues, then you don't care. But if it's high stakes, you certainly are going to care. All my kids, and yeah, we've established this for a while. If there's any ever a situation where we need to verify that they actually are who they are, and you're getting a ransom call,
you have a secret word. You have a secret word that you share only with your family,
and everyone knows what that is, right?
Yeah,
and it's not something that anybody can guess. It's something that only
it's watermelon. Our family knows. I'm on to you. It's watermelon.
Dude, I was going to say watermelon, Jerry. It's watermelon. Yeah. It's always
watermelon. Well, it was in Sunil's device config that we had him upload.
It's always watermelon. The answer to the question about the universe, watermelon.
anyway, thanks, process Sunil. Controls. Watch the show Dark Matter or read the book. You'll see how they use process controls to figure out who's who.
Wow. Wow. Well, speaking of South Korean CEOs, there was a CEO arrested apparently for this is one of those ones that if you haven't seen this headline it just blows your mind like what? So Korean CEO arrested for adding DDoS feature to satellite receivers. So to save everybody from having to dig through this, it was really interesting. So someone who manufactures satellite receivers for providers of those had a request from the provider to implement a DDoS module. You can kind of think of it as a botnet enrollment that then they could have, I guess, some kind of command and control or something like that, that they could use it to target the target of their choice. And I mean, that alone is interesting. And apparently after they put that in, they shipped them 85,000 receivers, and then they made it a firmware upgrade. And thanks to patching, thanks to everybody who patches, these devices all upgraded to make sure they had the latest DDoS module in there. And so now there's 240,000 devices in the field, and it had something to do with this kind of spat between these two operators and one of them and DDoSing each other, which is a whole ball of wax in itself. But what's interesting, it wasn't the person who wanted to use the DDoS feature, or I assume actually did use it, that is of interest in this. The CEO of the manufacturer, who was willing to put in some software that could be used in the primary use cases for malicious purposes, got arrested. Do you think that would happen in the U.S. if a software manufacturer packaged something like that at the behest of a customer?
Hey, I have a need to multicast something. Is there a way you can design this so that I can amplify my the packets out so that if let's say there's a boxing match that's happening and I'm just kind of concerned about bandwidth or because I expect a lot of people watching it, right? So I just need a way to turn on this amplification feature. Can you build that in for me? Thank you very much.
So you're saying it all depends on the paper trail.
Depends on the original intent, right?
And how the contract was worded.
There's way more DDoS capabilities that were built with good intent than there are those that were built with bad intent.
Yeah, I assume in this case there was a, Dear Mike, subject, can you add a DDoS module for me, please?
Yeah, I mean, if satellites become such a commodity that the profits are razor thin and that you would decide, I'm assuming the client request, you only have two clients, dude, or did they pay you a lot of money to do this? What the heck?
$4.25 million, I think, all in.
$4.2 million.
Well, that's what they seized from him and said that was the enrichment based on this. And I assume was the gross revenue from this. But yeah, I do think it's cutthroat. I mean, if you look for the number of XM radio flyers that I have to jam into my garbage can every day, it's a dirty, low margin business.
I mean, I think about, holy crap. I mean, I'm sure our governments are doing this already. They have these features already. All these our adversaries and our friends have these features already built into their satellites. Maybe not. I'm starting to think they do. It scares the hell out of me. And then the other thing is, what is going on with Korea, guys? I mean, I just had this weird stuff happening with their president.
Pretty volatile week, earlier, isn't it?
Yeah. Right? And he's like, "What the heck?" Like, "What? What? It's Korea's week." That's what I'm going to say. Yeah. That's all I can say about this.
Yeah. the last thing I wanted to jump into here. There was some like kind of innocuous email or announcements from Gmail and. This is funny to me. You have to like complete this list, right? Gmail, Outlook, and then, yep, AOL and Yahoo. Apparently those things still exist, but let's just take it at face value. Basically saying that the attacks on email accounts surged and there's more and more. And I think we all see that kind of from the threat intel space in that phishing messages, the payload, if you click them, is more times than not, it's not instant ownership. It's not Pegasus. It's usually a fake login page for email, whether it's a single-factor attack or whether it's a man-in-the-middle for a multi-factor one-time passwords. But what people want is that makes sense. With email accounts, you could do wire transfer fraud, right? You could do the fake wire change instructions at the last minute. You could do misinformation, whatever it is that you want. But what I think is pretty interesting about this is that I feel like these credentials, these kind of universal IDPs, which is what these things have become, are going to become the gatekeeper to like passkeys, right? And having things on chain, your Google accounts, the fact that you could have passkeys stored within the Google browser now, not to mention all your passwords that are in there. So I think that's really the pattern here. And when we talk about like the BYOD reality of modern companies today, I think at some point we're going to start allowing, and certainly we're doing it implicitly now, but explicitly allowing people to store credentials that are used in corporate environments on these, on their phone, which means the iCloud keychain, which means their Apple login. So I think the target on this is actually, whether or not it's surging yet, but it's particularly interesting because it is going to be a bridge into the enterprise pretty soon. And especially for all these companies that don't have any differentiation between logging into your Gmail from your home computer or work, or whatever else it is. Is that concerning? Is that going to be a totally different front than where we were at with the Active Directory and firewalls and VPNs and all that 15 years ago?
So actually, I think there's a different analogy here, which is email servers. And is running an email server a core competency for any organization? And of course, the answer is no, right? That's not what they care about. So then could you also ask the same question about running an IDP? Should that be a core competency for any organization? Because it certainly is a core competency for Microsoft and for Google and for Apple, right? If they don't
and
do
don't
that
forget
right,
AOL and Yahoo. Not the, that's a joke.
I did forget them. But that said, yes, for Apple, Google, and Microsoft, it is such a core competency that you can imagine the catastrophic outcomes if they fail in doing that. So I don't know. Is that a proper analogy? Is it a core competency that we believe that we have a false impression that we actually have when we shouldn't, and we could actually outsource that to Apple and be done with it?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I do think that that having, that we are forcing everyone to use these and it is outsourced. And so, yay, core competency approach. And, people aren't trying to build their own IDPs. But if you look at the settings on these platforms and trying to do like context-aware authentication, they're either very restricted to enterprise customers or they're just really difficult to comprehend and to get right. And there's tons of room for error. So it's not as, you put all your eggs in one basket and supposedly that's a core competency. I don't think they're very good at securing these things or making it easy for people to do the right thing.
I'm gonna be a little bit of a adversarial on this topic, right? And I'm gonna kick myself because I think I was the one who suggested talking about it, right? But the minute I think about AOL, especially AOL, okay, Yahoo maybe less, but AOL, vast majority of those freaking emails have malware on it or being compromised and they're being used for attacks on other people. It's just the wild west, man. Every time I see AOL emails, I don't even Who allows that anymore on your enterprise, right? I block AOL. We block AOL. We block Yahoo emails. Honestly, even if it was I know who was using Yahoo, but it's just so when I look at this, it's like, duh. Yeah, you're gonna find a ton of garbage in there, right? If your grandma and grandpa are still using that AOL, yeah, they're gonna be, there'll be probably a lot of those malware going through their Windows systems. And then I look at Kaspersky. I didn't even know Kaspersky was still around. Are this guy still around? So I'm like, I'm questioning this all and going, you know what? I'm sorry. I think this is a nothing burger. They saw a spike in AOL and Yahoo, and they threw in email, Gmail
Right.
and Microsoft Mail.
Fair enough. All right, guys. Any we should do our I think CrowdStrike stock is pretty stabilized at this point. It's almost getting uninteresting to track. But it definitely did come back, right?
Yeah, well, CrowdStrike went, is it go I don't know if it's stabilized, but Sentinel had a bad quarter, I think I read.
Oh, is
Which
that
is good.
right?
Yeah, so I think CrowdStrike is gonna look I would have thought Sentinel could do something there, and doesn't look like they didn't have a good quarter. And I
Oh,
know I'm
wow.
mixing the two, but what happens, it might impact CrowdStrike in a good way.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I mean, I'm just looking at a delta in them, and that's exactly what happened. They've been really outpacing them. Wow, that's going to be something to watch in the space.
Right,
All right.
in a quarter ago, Sentinel was talking junk about CrowdStrike and saying, come and use us.
Yeah.
And look what happened, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I thought that was a bad look, for what it's worth. But nah. Oh well. All right. Well, Sunil, I hope that you have a safe journey. I hope you continue to dodge any bad luck the way you did in Saudi Arabia. And thanks for joining in from that far away. And both of you guys, I hope that you enjoy the holidays. Tonight is actually our adversarial risk management company
Oh.
dinner, company party. And we are very small, so my wife was like, "Well, we're not going to be able to have it at our house for very long, so let's do it the last year that we can." So she's cooked up a storm, and we're going to have it at home, and this is going to be awesome.
Congratulations, man. That's awesome.
Yeah,
Three Michelin
it's
star.
great. Yeah, but without all the uppityness. All right, guys. Well, thanks a lot. I look forward to seeing you soon, and let's stay in touch. All